Hi, I'm Marie Crowe, and welcome back to Greenball, the Irish cricket podcast show. In this episode, we will be talking to former Australian cricketer Mike Whitney and current president of Randwick Petersham Cricket Club. The Sydney-based club, known affectionately as Randy Peets, they played host to the Ireland Men's T20 World Cup squad and coaching staff before the recent tournament, and have had a special relationship with Cricket Ireland since 2015 via an overseas scholarship programme. So let's get on with the show and speak to Mike in Sydney. Mike, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast today. It's amazing to speak to such a legend of the game. You've had such a fascinating career, but I'm just so curious, was playing cricket for Australia, being a pro, was that what you dreamed of when you were a kid?
Well, thanks for having me on, Marie. It's really nice to talk to you. Yeah, look, where I grew up in the area of Sydney, it was a really sporty area. I wouldn't say it was low socioeconomic, but look, my father was a truck driver and my mum was a home mum, and that was pretty much what it was. So there was a lot of sport played, and the major sports when I was growing up were rugby league, and we played a little bit of rugby union, and we played cricket in the summer, and we went down the beach. I grew up in pretty much a beachside suburb, and there was athletics as well. So I played all of those sports, and I had a dream of going to the Olympics because I was a great long jumper and triple jumper, pretty good rugby league player. So there was a dream of playing for our local club, which is the South Sydney Rabbitohs, which is a legendary club. And I always loved the cricket. And as I got older and those sports sort of, you know, worked their way out, I gave athletics away at about 15 and continued to play rugby league and cricket. And I got to about 20 and the cricket, I got into first grade cricket, but I was also playing rugby league, but I had a knee operation from the rugby league. And they said that you should give that away and concentrate on the cricket. So I did. And the rest is history, you know. I got to play for New South Wales for 14 years and played test cricket and one day cricket, went on a couple of tours with Australia. It was just, you know, that if it had been the rugby league or the athletics order, it's a dream come true, whichever one it is. And to play, the more I got into cricket, the more it just, you know, got me, you know, it was like a fish on a hook. I was just fascinated and the depth of it and the knowledge that you started to learn off the older players and how good they were. And then as I started to play some international cricket and played against, you know, Viv and David Gower and all these guys that were just amazing players. And then you work out, wow, they are really good and you better step it up if you want to compete. So it was a fascinating, absolutely fascinating ride. And the more I look back on it now at my age, because it's a long time ago, I nearly retired 30 years ago, I'm so humbled and grateful that I just had the opportunity to do that. Because when you're doing it, like you're on the roundabout and oh, you're out of this game and back for New South Wales and then playing a series and then you're off on a tour and then you might have a month off. And it's even busier now. So I reflect on it a bit more now and just go, wow, did I play with those guys and against those guys and met Sir Donald Bradman and all this sort of stuff? I mean, it's just bizarre.
It's been amazing by the sounds of it and quite idyllic as well, like just even growing up in the beach suburb and having access to all the different sports and been able to excel at them. And clearly even looking at you now, you can tell that you were so athletic, but you must have had a really good open mindset to be able to excel at so many sports and to learn all the time.
Yeah, I think, look, if my mum was still alive, she'd probably say that, you know, he spent too much time playing sport at school and not enough time studying. But there was a lot of us that did that, and there was a lot of really successful sports people that came from my area. And particularly, you know, there's a group above me of rugby league and cricketers that were really inspirational because they didn't come from really wealthy families and they didn't go to really expensive schools. They were just locals like we were, whose parents worked in the factory down at the chemical factory and all this sort of stuff. So there was a lot of inspiration, and we were very lucky where we lived, but there was also a lot of sporting facilities, and that's only increased because the people who are living in the area now and like I'm the president of the club now, so I'm always trying to get, you know, better sports facilities and can we have that rebuild and all this. So it's my turn now to do all that. But the people before me and before that were very, very smart in making sure that that particular place was a sports field, and it was never going to have houses or units or flats built on it. So there was a lot of sport played, and it was pretty competitive where I grew up. So I think that gave some of the people from my area a bit of an edge as well.
Yeah, it sounds like it. One of the things that people will always remember you for and remember your career for is your debut. So you were in England playing league cricket. Tell us what happened.
1981, I played my first season for New South Wales, and I think I only played four games, and the rest I was 12th man, so it was a bit of a learning, really steep learning curve. And a lot of the New South Wales players and a lot of the club players in Sydney had been going over to play, particularly in some of the leagues that were in Lancashire. And there was a bit of a misconception here that it was the Lancashire League, but it wasn't. There was the Lancashire League, the Central Lancashire League, the Northern Lancashire League. There was about 10 leagues in Lancashire, and depending on the level of that, you could go over there and earn some money and play cricket. So some of the guys had played at this club called Fleetwood, and I thought, I'd been to England on a six-week tour in 1978 with my club Randwick, and boy, that was it was fun, and we played great cricket, and this was the home of cricket, and it was England, and it was so different to Australia, and I'd never seen anything like that, and the stone fences and the old, really old buildings, and they go, oh, no, this one's not old. It was built in 1420. Well, to us, that's really old, you know. So it was an amazing eye-opener, cultural cricket, and I wanted to go back there. So I signed up with Fleetwood in the Northern League, and Fleetwood's just up the road from Blackpool. And I've got to tell you, when I went into Blackpool for the first time with a mate of mine, an Australian who came with me, who was the amateur, and I was the professional, we got into Blackpool and we just looked at each other and said, man, what is this place? This is the weirdest venue, like, in the history of the world. And there was just a Bucks night going on over there and a Hens venue going on over there and a really weird nightclub there, the piers out into the ocean. So that was an eye-opener as well. And they just drank so much ale in this place. We'd never drunk that much than these people could drink in Fleetwood. But they were fantastic. We're still friends with those people now, all these years later. We talk a lot, and if someone passes away, and a lot of them have come out here, and, you know, there's messages sent all the time. Anyway, about a third of the way through the season, I had a mate from New South Wales playing at Gloucestershire, and a couple of their fast bowlers had broken down, including the great all-rounder from South Africa, Mike Proctor. And Greg Geese rang me at Fleetwood and said they're looking for a quick, and, you know, if you get some time off Fleetwood, so come and play. So I rang the chairman at Fleetwood, and he said, go down and have a trial, but you've got to play for us. But if there's a midweek three-day game or a Sunday league game, we'll give you permission to play that. So I went down, had a trial with Gloucester, signed up with them, played a couple of games, one against Sri Lanka, one against Hampshire. And during a third game, I was sitting on the balcony, and Australia was touring England, 1981, Ashes tour. And the room attendant brought a phone out and said, Mr. Whitney, it's a phone call for you. So I picked it up, and there was this guy there saying, you've been picked in the Australian team. And I thought it was someone G'ing up, so I told him to, you know, and hung the phone up. Anyway, the phone rang back a couple of minutes later, and it was the manager of the Australian cricket team saying, two of our fast bowlers have broken down, Rodney Hogg and Jeff Lawson, and you've been selected to come to join the team to fill in. Leave that game now and drive up to Manchester and flock into the hotel and come up to my room and I'll tell you what's going on. So I did that, like a two-hour drive, and the brain was going, what's going on here? Like, I was 22 years of age and I'd played six first-class matches. So I did that, got to the hotel, went up to the room, knocked on the door, and there was Fred Bennett, who I knew Fred from New South Wales. He was an esteemed player in his younger days, an administrator. And Kim Hughes, the Australian captain, was sitting on the bed, who I'd only met once, walked in and looked and sort of shook hands, and Fred said, well, Kim. And Kim said, well, you're going to play tomorrow. We didn't bring you up to carry the drinks. We got enough people to do that. So tomorrow you're going to make your debut for Australia in the fifth test at Old Trafford, and go upstairs now to this room. Your gear will be up there. And in 2 hours' time, we're going to have a press conference to announce that you're going to make your debut tomorrow. So that was going to be my seventh first-class game. And the thing with this, I got up to the room and opened it, and all, there was all this gear in it, because in those days you roomed with someone else. And I thought, oh, who's this, you know? And I looked on this beautiful leather-crafted port, like a suitcase in the corner, and embossed in gold letters on top was DK Lilly, who, to us, mate, this was the dude we grew up watching. This was our... This is God, you know. And he opened the door about 5 minutes later, and I stood at attention. I didn't even know what to say. And I roomed with the great Dennis Lilly in my first test match. I mean, what a story. Amazing.
It just would never happen now, you know, the whole scenario, the whole way it played out. Amazing.
And never happened. Never, ever.
Am I right in saying you barely got into the ground?
Barely got into the ground, because Dennis... Whatever Dennis did the next morning, I just did. When he had a shower, went to the toilet and cleaned his teeth, I was straight in there after him, waiting, packed the bags, I'm ready to roll. So finally we go downstairs, go to the brekkie room, no one's there. He said, we've missed the bus. It left like 10 minutes ago. Oh, no, I'm frozen. Got a mate of his to take us to the ground, went to walk into the ground because he's talking to the mate in there, and the bloke would not let me in, the old bloke in the white jacket, the 85-year-old white jacket door attendant went, who are you? And I went, well, I'm playing today, mate. And he said, no, you're not. And he had to ring up to the dressing room. Finally, I get up there, and Kim Hughes goes, I said, I'm 15 minutes late. First day, first test. Don't even know half the guys in the room. Like, I played half a season for New South Wales. Sat down, he said, sit down. I said, mate, I'm sorry. He said, don't think you're special. Don't think you're smart. Dennis does this to everybody who makes their debut. So I went, oh, thank God. I like the pressure just let off. Anyway, we bowled that morning, you know, within a couple of hours. We're out there bowling, and David Gower was my first wicket, and I had like four overs, one for eight, and the clouds were like at the level of my ceiling, and it rained a little bit, and it was just surreal, surreal. Mm. And Ian Botham's in the opposition, and Alan Knott's the wicket keeper, and, you know, Jeff Boycott opened the batting. I mean, I'm just there going, mate, is this, like, real? Am I dreaming this? And anyway, I stayed with the team and played in the sixth test and played a couple of county games and a one-day game, then went back to Gloucestershire and played the last county game of the season against Lancashire, then went back to Fleetwood and finished the season there. So it was like this, whoa, like this. And it was such an amazing year in England. There were riots and strikes. Princess Diana and Charles got married. Mm-hmm. Bobby Sands was the first Irishman to go on hunger strike and died. And I remember how huge that was and how poignant that moment was. And my grandmother's Irish, so I'm connected to you people, and my grandfather's Scottish, so I have a lot of Celtic blood in me, and I will never forget that and how sad that was. But it was a really amazing year, and that series ended up being called Botham's Ashes. And I think back now and go, man, I played two tests in Botham's Ashes as a 22-year-old, and I had absolutely no idea what was going on at the time, because you're just in la-la land almost. It's just so surreal.
It actually sounds like a movie. I'm surprised that somebody hasn't made a movie about that year, because it's amazing, the whole story. So just on your career, what do you think was your kind of your standout moment, the moment that defined you?
Look, I had a couple of really big moments playing for Australia. I took a couple of sevenfers, one against the West Indies and one against India. The one against the West Indies in 1989 was very satisfying, because I played those two tests in England and then couldn't get back into the team until 1987. And that was an amazing test, not for my bowling, for my batting. I blocked out Sir Richard Hadlee, and we drew, and, you know, look, he'd who were, mate, I averaged like five with the bat. How was I ever going to block out Sir Richard Hadlee? But Craig McDermott and I hung in there for five overs and we drew the game and it gave us a 1-0 win and Alan Border's first win as a test captain and all this stuff. And I couldn't get back in the side for reasons. The preferred bowlers were not injured. And this fifth test against West Indies at Adelaide on the best batting wicket in the world with Greenwich, Haynes, Richardson, Richards, Logie, Hooper, Bujon, and the quick bowlers were Marshall, Kirtley, Courtney, Patrick Patterson. So they had a pretty good side. And it was the last test. And I took 7 for 89 in the first innings off 30 overs and just bowled unbelievably amazing and then took 2 wickets in the second inning. So I took 9 for the match. There was only 14 West Indian wickets taken in the whole game and one of those was a run out. So out of the 13 wickets, I took 9. And I just had this amazing game. And it was satisfying because Greg Chappell had written an article prior to the match saying I wasn't up to test standard and the West Indies were just going to pummel me all over the ground on this amazing Adelaide best batting wicket in the world. So I felt pretty good about that. And then there was a bit of structural change in Cricket Australia and Bobby Simpson was the coach and he'd coached me at New South Wales and he knew of my training regime, that I was up for it, that I'll give you, you know, the last ounce that I've got in my body. If you need me to bowl for an hour at the end of the day, I'm fit enough, I'm solid, I'll be running in for you. I love the team, love the boys. So he got a lot of players together at the time like that. And part of that was a hub from New South Wales, Mark Taylor, Steve Waugh, Mark Waugh, myself, Greg Matthews. And we were really close teammates as well. And I think the rest of the Australian team fed off that. It became a really successful period of time. Alan Border's back end of his career was very successful. Then Mark Taylor, then Steve Waugh. And it just rolled on, but it pretty much started then. And I got to play a lot more between sort of 90 and 93 when I pretty much had my last knee operation and couldn't play anymore. But I got to tour the West Indies and Sri Lanka. That was great. But look, on those performances, I also took 7 for 27 against India in Perth. And that was only 12 overs. So it was totally the opposite to the other one, you know, 30 overs. 7 for 89, 12 overs, 7 for 27. 7 fers, 5 fers are rare. 6 fers are rarer. 7 fers, rarefied air, really. And you get an 8 or a 9 for, well, you know, they come around, you know, once every 5 careers. So to have 2 7 fers in 12 test matches is, man, I just think about that and it's just amazing. And to block out Sir Richard Hadlee was amazing. And, you know, I know Richard really well now. We sit down and laugh about it. He's really disappointed because he couldn't get me or Billy McDermott out and the quality that he was. And he says it's one of his most disappointing moments. And I'm there going, yeah. And look, winning a Sheffield Shield as well with your teammates at New South Wales, because the Sheffield Shield competition is a really tough competition to win. It's very, very competitive. It's played on all the test grounds. It's really serious. And I got to win 4 of those with New South Wales. And those moments, you know, we're still celebrating them now, 30 and 40 years down the track.
Magic, absolutely magic. So I'm looking at you and you have your Randy Peets shirt on and it has the Ireland cricket logo there and I'm seeing O'Neill's too. Tell us about the connection with Cricket Ireland and your club. How did it start and what does it mean to you?
It started in 2015 when Ireland qualified for the 50-over World Cup, which was staged here in Australia. And about 18 months, well, just when Ireland qualified and all the teams were known, about 18 months before that, two young members of our club, John Stewart and John McLaughlin, said, why don't we host one of these international cricket teams for a week prior? And, you know, if we focus on, you know, a minnow sort of side, that, and I went, you've got to be joking, haven't you? I've been away with international cricket teams. I know what's required. This is like a lot bigger than what you think, but go away and write me a paper and bring it back. So they did, and it looked okay. So we had 18 months. In that time, John Stewart became our CEO and started connecting with guys like Richard Holdsworth at Cricket Ireland and, and Roy Torrens when Roy was still alive and he was managing the sides and stuff like that. And Phil Simmons was coaching then. I'd played against Phil for the West Indies, Australia, and had seen Phil in England many times. So he knew that if I, as the president of the club, was going to say ABC, ABC was going to be done. I mean, I wasn't going to have them over here and mm-hmm. we've said this, but we couldn't provide that. So we started ticking these things off anyway. That went ahead and it was really successful because we sort of activated the Consul General here in New South Wales. Her name was Jane Connolly. Lovely lady, really supportive. Spoke to Noel White, who was the High Commissioner in Canberra. Really supportive. Activated O'Neill's. People like Waterford Crystal, who gave us a fantastic, you know, Crystal mm-hmm. Award for the winners of the game. So Ireland trained all week. We played them on the Friday, and it was really successful. And they went on to win, I think they beat the West Indies, maybe Zimbabwe, and I think the UAE in that tournament as well. And a lot of them said to have that week at Coogee, which is right on the beach. Our ovals, you know, you cross the road, you're on Coogee Beach, and they were staying there, and we'd organise them to have breakfast there and train on the ground here. And if there was wet weather, we'd had indoor cricket nets available and bus them around and all this sort of stuff. And they all said that it was a wonderful experience, and it definitely helped get the momentum going for that World Cup. And we'd made these connections. So John Stewart then kept these connections going. Him and a couple of our guys went over for Ireland's first test, I think, at Malahide, and celebrated that with the boys in Ireland a few years ago. We started to get players over to play for us on a scholarship. We've had Andrew Balburney, Barry McCarthy, Jack Harry Tector, and Tim Tector's with us this season. Stephen, I hope I get this name right, pronounced Doheny. Is that good?
Yeah, thank you. That's good, yeah.
Because I thought when Stephen played the season he played for us, I just thought Stephen was one of the most amazing players that I'd seen for his age. But, man, he can't get in that side because Lorcan Tucker is just absolutely on fire and beautiful soft hands. So, but we can talk about the depth of Irish cricket in a minute. So we started having these players and we were pretty keen to get some of our guys over there. And one of our players has been over last season, which was great. But we started just having all those fantastic connections with Cricket Ireland. So Cricket Ireland make the 2022 T20 World Cup. And only about 5 months ago, it wouldn't have been any more than that, John Stewart, who's still our CEO, goes, Ireland's made it. And then they said, but we've only got 4 months. But, you know, what are we going to... But we had the bones of what we'd done in 2015 and, again, activated the current Consul General, Rosie Keane, who was just unbelievably supportive. The High Commissioner, Tim Moore from Canberra, again, jumped on board and said, anything we can do. And we had these connections as well. I mean, Nathan Horitz played for us at Randwick Petersham. He's now part of the coaching staff for the Irish setup. All of our local politicians jumped on board. Rosie activated the Lansdowne Club here in Sydney, which is a total Irish club, and we got some sponsorship from that. So we pulled it together very quickly, and we scheduled to have 3 games. We got one done on the Tuesday, the Wednesday was rained out, and the Friday was rained out. But there were alternative things for the boys to do. But again, it was a wonderful week to have them here. We feel like we're brothers, and our club and Cricket Ireland is part of that setup now. And as the president, I'm really proud because if I think of all the clubs in Sydney, and some are bigger than others and, you know, have more infrastructure and better organised, even the really big clubs would shudder to take something of that size on. And when I think that our club's done it twice now, and, you know, we're just a local grade cricket club. We're fairly big and well-structured and well-run, but to have a connection with an international cricket team, and Ireland from 2015 has just gone like this and is starting to produce world-class players. I mean, Josh Little gets a hat-trick in a T20 World Cup. I mean, that's a memorable moment forever. So we're just humbled and grateful to have the connection that we have. And both of those things, 2015, 2022, were really successful. Mm-hmm. And when I've had a word with Balbo about it, he said a number of things to me. Fantastic time, gave us a run in. But he's also said the period of time that he spent with our club in one of your winters and our summer, he was a little bit lost, and we actually helped him turn it around in his melon and turn his game around a little bit. He went on a score and a lot of runs, and now he's the captain. So, you know, how do we feel about that? Wow.
Yeah.
To have a little piece of Balbo career and him saying that about us and our club is, man, I'm just humbled about it all.
You must be actually really proud of the players that have come through your club and seeing how well they're doing, and just even seeing the progress that cricket is making here in Ireland.
Absolutely. I mean, every one of those players that I've mentioned, Barry's done really well. Stephen's yet to get his chance. Protectors, I know Jack's not playing as much at the moment, but, you know, Harry looks a fine player, didn't have the best T20, but was a bit unlucky, hit a few straight to the field and stuff like that. And Tim looks a really good young player as well. And I met Alice.
I was going to say
a couple of weeks ago because Heatley and Anita were out traveling around, and Heatley on the side said she's the best of the lot. So I went on. Yeah. I won't be saying that to the boys. But yeah, look, the problem I see with these smaller nations, and you know, I hate saying that, and I don't want to say Minna, but Zimbabwe, Ireland, the ICC needs to put more money into these smaller countries that haven't got the bigger base like we have, whatever, to allow coaches like Nathan Horrocks, so Ireland can say, come over and live here, we can give you a house, pay your FS, and pay you this much money, and so that international coaches will say, well, yeah, that's pretty good money, so I'll go and spend 3 seasons with Ireland and do what I've got to do. And I know, we all know, that the ICC has got plenty, billions. So I can't ever understand how the distribution can be not so much for the, even Holland. Holland's starting to produce some really good cricketers, and they had some great moments in the T20 World Cup as well. Why wouldn't you be funding money into Holland now and trying to stimulate all their cricket and get coaches there? So anyway, that's only my old opinion.
Yeah, well, it makes sense for sure. So when you're, you know, when Ireland are playing and doing well, are people within Randy Peet's getting on board, watching it, curious, interested, supportive? Are there Ireland jerseys going around the place?
Yeah, everybody's following Ireland in our club. Ireland's our, the only time I can't barrack for Ireland is when they're playing against Australia. But the big moment was when they beat England. And I had some people go, oh, but it was DLS. And I say, it was in the middle of the 15th over in the second part of the game. It wasn't like it was five overs. This was 35 overs had been played and Ireland were in front. And, yeah, because I sort of, you know, Australia, Ireland, but anybody who's playing England, I'm barracking for them. And to see Ireland win that night was huge. And my phone, and between the club and the WhatsApp club, and how big's this, and for every moment that night that Josh Little took that hat trick, mate, my phone just went off. When Balbo got that 60 odd against England that night, the phone just kept going off. So yeah, big following here. But I suppose also you've got to understand, I live in a part of the eastern suburb, and there's a lot of Irish live around here, and in the shops and people working in the cafes and the bars around Coogee and Maroubra and this eastern suburbs area where I live, a lot of Irish, a lot of support.
Yeah, there's such a huge community there, such a massive connection with the country, that's for sure. Mike, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been brilliant, and it's just so lovely to see how much respect and love you have for Irish cricket and for everything that you and the club have done for all of the people who have passed through over the last few years. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again soon. That's the show for today. We have two more episodes this year to come. The first episode will be a wrap of the Ireland men's campaign at the T20 World Cup and looking ahead to 2023, while the second episode will be a wrap of the Ireland women's Pakistan tour and looking ahead to 2023 as well. So the best idea is to make sure you subscribe to the channel and get the latest episode of the Green Ball Podcast.